This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. On July 20th, 1969, 8 years after President John F. Kennedy pledged to land a man on the moon and return him safely to Earth, two astronauts from Apollo 11 guided their lunar lander onto the moon's surface.
600 million people around the world, including just about every American household with a TV, watched the event live and heard the crackle of astronaut Neil Armstrong's voice reporting back to Mission Control in Houston.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
The culmination of more than a decade of intense scientific and technological groundwork made the lunar landing possible. But an often overlooked component of the American mission to the moon was the marketing it took to capture the public's attention, educate the public, and keep public money flowing to make it all possible.
David Meerman Scott argues the Apollo Lunar Program was one of the most successful marketing campaigns and public relations campaigns in history. Scott lives here in Boston, and along with Richard Jurek, he's co-author of the new book, Marketing the Moon, The Selling of the Apollo Lunar Program. And David Meerman Scott, welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's really fun. What a fun book, and I should say there's a lot of great writing in it too, but it's the kind of book that's full of wonderful pictures that really bring back that whole era. You write that NASA made a fundamental choice at the beginning of its race to the moon, and that was to make this public, to make this project public. Why did that turn out to be such an important decision?
It was important because we were able to share it with the American people. And NASA was able to share what was happening with the people who funded the program. And I would contrast that with two things that were completely the opposite. One was the Russian program. Mm. And the Russian program, I mean, you didn't hear anything until they landed and it was successful. And the other was the American military, which is where a lot of the people came from in the original part of the space program, and particularly in the Mercury and Gemini programs. And there were a lot of people who were arguing that we should do what we do with the military, is only talk about something when there's so-called fire in the tail or the rocket is actually going up in the air. But fortunately, we made the entire program open so that we could see all the good things and a few of the bad things as well.
Right. So that really had a lot to do with the public sort of getting excited and supporting it. Initially, though, it wasn't a popular decision with everyone. For example, you mentioned the astronauts didn't want all of that live publicity at the beginning. Why not?
No. Because the things that were happening live was there was live television.
Yeah.
So they had to get out a camera while they were in the spacecraft and record themselves doing live television. And then everything they were saying on the air-to-ground loop was also broadcast live or could be broadcast live. It was delivered to radio stations and television stations around the world. So the astronauts think, well, gosh, we have to worry about what we're saying and what happens if we swear and these sorts of things. And so they were really concerned about this, and many of them were arguing against it. Hmm. And fortunately, some of the public affairs officers like Paul Haney and some of the astronauts, for example, Tom Stafford, argued that, no, we've got to make this open. We've got to make this the American way of we're going to tell it like it is. And that was great because that allowed us to witness that lunar landing. And I was 8 years old when Apollo 11 landed, and we could watch it in our living room. We could watch Neil Armstrong take those first steps. And that might not have happened if the other side had gotten their way around that argument.
It's so interesting, too, and you write about this, about, I mean, obviously putting a man, astronauts, on the moon and figuring out how to build a rocket to get them there and back safely was a huge technological feat. But you make the point that live TV from the moon was a huge technological feat and one of the big technical challenges that had to be resolved.
It was huge. I mean, the audaciousness of the project in general is just crazy. I mean, land people on the surface of the moon using 1969 technology, or when they started, early 1960s technology.
Yeah.
Amazing. But then you had to have a camera that was small. It was basically the size of a bread box and lightweight. Because getting some poundage to the surface of the moon was hugely expensive from the perspective of the technology required to get it there, the fuel required to get it there. And in fact, the engineers hated the idea of having to build the idea of a camera in there.
Because that adds, what, an extra 20 pounds to the payload or
Exactly. Yeah. And so that means they had to get rid of something else. As well, they didn't have the bandwidth at that time to get live television using the current technology of the day back to the Earth. So they had to actually rig up a system where they were actually getting rid of some of the scan lines. It was really, really complicated, but essentially specifically for the Apollo program. And then some of that technology could then be used in other ways. Like until that time, we never had live television from war correspondents, for example. And you think of all the things we have today, it directly leads to social media and my camera on my iPhone, the technology we built then.
Fascinating. I want to ask you about how we learned as Americans about the astronauts, because they become really sort of heroic in the way they're marketed. And one of the ways that happened was a Life magazine profile of these Apollo astronauts. So how did this come about?
Well, that was really interesting, because what was really clever by the NASA public affairs people was that they realized that the public was going to be demanding of the time of the astronauts to learn all about them, not just the space travel aspect of what they were doing, but also their personal lives. I mean, today it's just granted that you get to learn the personal lives of celebrities, but back then it wasn't so granted. So they came up with an arrangement with Life magazine to allow them exclusive access to the astronauts' personal stories. So that means things like where do they go to church and what does their house look like? They invited them into their homes, information about their families, their children, their wives, and so on. And they were granted that exclusivity, which allowed the astronauts to be able to have their personal time be their personal time. And otherwise, they would have reporters from publications all over the world jumping their fence, trying to get an exclusive, interviewing their kids. And this stuff was actually happening until that contract was organized. However, the professional side, getting to the moon, the technology, what the astronauts were doing from their professional lives, that was all fair game. It was just that personal story that was exclusive to Life. And that was a great decision. They actually went all the way to President Kennedy to get that decision made.
Didn't that require a certain amount of the press sort of playing along? Because some of these astronauts, and you mentioned this, powerful attractions to women. They boozed, they smoked, not all of them, but some of them, right? And the press sort of played along and didn't advertise that part of it.
Some of them smoked cigarettes, absolutely, and they went out and had a good time. But interestingly, they went out and had a good time with reporters. And there was cozy relationship between the way that the reporters and the astronauts interacted in a way that probably couldn't happen today, because there'd be somebody who would be snapping a photo, there'd be someone who wanted to spill the beans on what was going on. And in that case, the astronauts and the reporters had a great relationship. We never really learned that so-and-so was having an affair, or this one drank too much, or that one was smoking cigarettes.
You know, you point out that this role that the press played was so important that after Apollo 11 lands on the moon, the lead NASA rocket scientist, Wernher von Braun, actually thanked the press for helping to make this possible.
He didn't say anything. This is the guy who built the Saturn V rocket. He didn't say anything as it lifted off, or as it went to the moon, or as they landed on the moon. It was only after they were safely returning home that he stood up in front of the world's press, hundreds and hundreds of reporters, and basically said, thank you very much, because without public affairs, without the press, we never would have gotten to the moon. And so, wow, what a fantastic statement. Because they had to, we, the press, had to convince the American public and Congress people to fund 4% of our national budget and have 2% of our national workforce focused on a project to get a few people onto the surface of the moon. It seems audacious, but that's what they had to do.
So 4% of our national budget.
Over the course of a decade.
The course of a decade to make that lunar landing possible. How does that compare to NASA's budget today?
It's much, much, much larger. NASA's budget is way less than 1% today. Oh. So it's a huge, huge difference. So be able to put it in perspective, I mean, it's just like something like almost 10 times the number that NASA has today. Mm. And NASA's doing good work in robotics. You know, what we're doing on Mars is really interesting, but we don't have the budget, or I don't think the national commitment to do huge, audacious projects around human space travel.
And why is that? I mean, you write in the book that the moon mission, in a way, was a victim of its own success. I mean, it accomplished the major goal of getting people on the moon, but then it sort of didn't have a second act, did it?
Well, and that was partly a fault of the marketing. And in fact, if I look at them, any mistakes that they made, the mistake they made is they had this crazy audacious goal, and everyone was aiming towards this goal. And that was a great way to get all of this funded, and it was a great way to get everybody pointed into the right direction. But as soon as Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin stepped foot on the surface of the moon, we were essentially done. I mean, we still had a number of other Apollo missions. But from the perspective of how we marketed as a quest story, as remember John F. Kennedy's Rice University speech, nothing will be so difficult as this. And once we reached it, we kind of like, oh, my gosh, what do we do next? So they never really had a significant follow-on. I mean, yeah, we did some interesting things, Apollo Soyuz and so on. But essentially, we've been stuck in low Earth orbit since 1972.
That's disappointing, isn't it? I mean, especially, you're much more knowledgeable than just the average person who was a kid then. Do you miss that? I mean, would you like to see something sort of rise to that level as the moonshot?
I would love to see something like that. I would love to see us have a project to get to Mars or to get to an asteroid or something. We had something minor that I think struck people as being equally interesting, but it was so short-lived, which was Felix Baumgartner's leap from the Red Bull Stratos, which was a couple of years ago. And Apollo 11 was the largest television live audience. Hmm. But Felix Baumgartner's jump was the largest YouTube stream ever in history.
It's quite a thing. I've seen this on YouTube. I don't know if all of our listeners has, but this is a guy who basically jumps out of what? He's practically in low Earth orbit.
He is, right? Is technically in space, 200-something thousand miles above this. 200-something thousand feet above the surface of the Earth, and he jumps out of a balloon, and he literally jumps out of space, and it was all carried live on the web. And yes, you could see it on television too, but most people saw it on the web, and so we can do audacious things. We can get people interested. We just have to aim really high and put muscle behind it from the financial perspective, but also, I believe, the marketing perspective. It doesn't just happen. You know, we have an opportunity to put money behind a project. We need to sell the idea of that project.
When we talk about the sort of marketing effort to market the moon, we haven't yet talked about how businesses played a role in this, right? I mean, because the whole effort to get men on the moon involved all kinds of businesses of that produced everything from Tang to watches to rocket engines, right?
Exactly.
They were all
from spacecraft to nuts and bolts. And there's an interesting aspect here, because NASA's public affairs department was tiny. They had very few people who were devoted to public affairs, but every single one of thousands of contractors had marketing and public relations people that worked for them. So when you're talking about IBM and Raytheon and Boeing and McDonnell Douglas and Grumman and all these companies building spacecraft and spacecraft parts, and then you had consumer products that were carried into space like Omega watches and Tang and Sony tape recorders, every single one of those companies wanted to be associated with this amazing Apollo program, especially the contractors who are also building weapons of war for the Vietnam War. I mean, imagine if you're building missiles and you're also building the components for the Apollo program. You want to get the idea, yeah, we're building these spacecrafts, aren't we a great company? And maybe kind of ignore that other part. But we wouldn't have made it to the moon without the contractors, obviously, but we wouldn't have made it without the contractors' marketing muscle either, because NASA represented something like less than 10% of the marketing and PR people compared to all of the other ones that the contractors were putting behind it, which was essential for the success of the program.
Well, David Meerman Scott, he's co-author with Richard Jurek of the new book, Marketing the Moon, The Selling of the Apollo Lunar Program. He lives here in Boston. And David, thanks so much for joining us. It's a great read and fascinating bit of history.
Thanks so much, Anthony. It was really great.
Thank you for coming in.